Okay. I thank you. I'm Bob Rubin, and on behalf of all my colleagues at the Hamilton Project, let me welcome you to today's discussion of immigration, an issue that I'm sure all of us recognize is critical to our economy. The Hamilton Project was begun about 6 years ago, and it brought together an unusual combination of policy experts, academics, and business people. Our objective was to put forth policy proposals and provide discussion in important economic areas. The point was not to endorse specific proposals, but rather to help contribute to serious discussion about the critical issues of our economy. I could make the argument, I think it is the case, that the Hamilton Project's commitment to seriousness of purpose with respect to economic policy issues is more important today than ever, both with the seriousness of the challenges we face and with the nature of much of public discourse about those issues. Clearly, the difficult conditions in the economy, the many hardships that far too many Americans face, are the pressing imperative for policymakers, and the Hamilton Project has had and convened serious discussions with respect to various of these matters, the stimulus, mortgage relief, and other areas. But having said that, our primary focus is on a long-term strategy for our country to succeed at a time of historic transformation of the global economy. We believe that the United States, with its dynamic culture and its other advantages, can succeed in this transforming global economy, but that to do so, our political system will have to meet many hugely consequential challenges. We define economic success as competitiveness, growth, broad-based and inclusive participation in the benefits of that growth, and increased economic security. We believe in a market-based economy, but we also believe equally in a strong role for government to meet the many purposes that markets, by their very nature, will not provide. Today, our two distinguished speakers and our two panels with truly outstanding discussants, will address the critical challenges facing our economy with respect to immigration and to developing a sound immigration policy. Most of the Hamilton Project's events have been based on scholarly papers that have then been subject to rigorous academic peer review. But in order to move expeditiously on an issue that is of such current importance, we will not have underlying papers for this particular set of discussions, but instead, a discussion by one panel of academic and policy experts and a second panel of practitioners in segments of our economy that are strongly affected by immigration. You also have at your seat a set of facts, and some of them I think you will find quite surprising, that relate to the economic aspects and effects of immigration. Then at some point subsequent to today's meeting, we'll issue a strategy paper that will reflect the discussion we are all having today. I'm not going to get into the substantive aspects of immigration, but let me just make a few framing comments. Immigration, as we all know, has, over the life and history of our country, played an enormously important role in our economy and in our society. It is a contentious issue in many areas of the country where there are strong arguments and strong feelings about immigration and its impact on our society, our economy, our labor market, and fiscal matters. In addition, there are complex and divisive issues about how to balance the rights of individuals and the need to enforce our laws. All of these debates are likely to continue for a long time to come. The conclusion that we reached at the Hamilton Project was that we could provide value added to these debates by a serious endeavor, which is today's discussions and papers, related materials, a serious endeavor to contribute to helping establish the facts and to contribute to helping make judgments about immigration and the various economic, and most particularly, the various economic impacts of immigration. Our discussion today can be broken into two broad categories. The first is the substantial role that lower-skilled immigrants play in many industries and the enormous contribution that that makes to our economy. The second is the competitive advantage and the benefit that our businesses, universities, healthcare institutions, and many other areas of high-skilled and high-knowledge activity have long enjoyed due to the ability to attract to our shores the best and the brightest from around the world. Some have come as students and then remained. Others have come long advanced and well-developed in their careers. And just to show you how widely the reduction in the H-1B visas that allow these high-skilled individuals to come to this country, just to show you how widely the large reduction in these visas has affected our country, I was with a senior military officer the other day, and he said that the reduction in the H-1B visas, this very large reduction, has had a real negative impact on the military with respect to its research and its science. And a corporate CEO told me the other day that they are now having to move certain activities offshore, out of the United States, in order to employ skilled people from abroad who could not be brought into this country. Let me outline our program at this time and briefly introduce our speakers and our panel members. I will not go into their resumes because those are in your materials. Our first panel will consist of academic experts with respect to immigration and immigration policy. The moderator will be Michael Greenstone, the director of the Hamilton Project and professor of economics at MIT. He will be joined by three outstanding panelists, Giovanni Perry, professor of economics at the University of California at Davis, James Smith, senior economist at the RAND Corporation and principal investigator, New Immigrant Survey, and Darrell West, vice president, director, governance studies at the Brookings Institution. The second panel will be moderated by Mark McKinnon, vice chairman of public strategies in Austin, Texas, and member of the advisory council of the Hamilton Project. He will be joined as panelists by three well-informed and extremely knowledgeable practitioners who are affected in their institutional activities by immigration. Lydia Tomez, head of global immigration, the Microsoft Corporation. John Wilhelm, president of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union. And Steve Hyman, the former director of the National Institute of Mental Health and now provost at Harvard University. After the two panel discussions, Roger Altman, former deputy secretary of the Treasury and now chairman of the investment bank Evercore Partners, will introduce our two distinguished speakers, Melody Barnes, assistant to the president for domestic policy, and Bill Richardson, governor of the state of New Mexico. Bill's appearance will be on videotape because the governor will be accompanying President Obama on a just scheduled visit by the president to New Mexico today. And as always, we are deeply grateful to our colleagues at the Brookings Institution for all that they do with us every day to help make our work possible. We have a terrific program, and I think we all owe great thanks to the two people who put it together. Michael Greenstone, as I said a moment ago, the director of the Hamilton Project, and Karen Anderson, the managing director of the Hamilton Project. With that, it is my pleasure to turn the podium over to Michael Greenstone. Michael.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you, everyone, for coming today. I think our starting point at the Hamilton Project for thinking about immigration as an important issue of public policy was that the most plain insight one can have is we're a country of immigrants. And immigration is an important policy issue, and reform seems to be in the air. I'm not an expert on what causes policy to become popular all of a sudden, but it does seem that there's a few factors that must be at play. The first is the share of our population that are foreign-born is now up to 12%. That is the highest level since 1910, and it's been rising for about 3.5 decades. 30% of immigrants are undocumented. A third reason is that immigrants are spread unevenly around the country, and so that means that their impacts are felt differentially particular regions. And then finally, we're in the midst of very trying economic times, and I think it's natural in a period of trying economic times to raise important questions about immigration and public policy. When we set out to work on this topic, we were struck, I think the number one thing that struck us is we're struck by an absence of facts or an absence of a consensus around a series of facts. Two examples help illustrate this. The first is, do immigrants raise the living standards of natives or lower the living standards of natives? I think you can find either viewpoint out there. Another question that seems to draw a lot of attention that I think there has not always been a clear set of facts about is, do immigrants bust the budgets of the federal and local governments? So what we set out to do is to sell copies of this wonderful document that has 10 facts about immigration. And our aim is not to reach a political consensus, but rather to develop a set of facts that people on all sides of the immigration debate can agree on. And the thinking behind that is that without a set of facts to ground the discussion, it's very difficult to develop rational policy. So with that framing, I wanted to introduce our panel. Bob mentioned them briefly. I thought I would add a little extra. Giovanni Perry is here. He's a professor at the University of California of Davis. He has done some fundamental work on the impacts of immigration on the wages of native-born U.S. residents. He has, I think his life has become consumed by writing these papers. Also to my right, we have Jim Smith from the RAND Corporation. He is probably too modest to admit it, but I think he's widely considered to be the godfather of immigration research. He was the author of an important National Academy of Sciences study. And to my left, we have Darrell West from Brookings. He's the Vice President and Director of Governance and has written a very important book called Brain Gain about high school immigration. So with that in mind, I thought I would start off the panel by asking questions of each of the panelists, and then hopefully we'll lead into discussion. So I thought I would begin with Giovanni. And Giovanni, can you tell us what the impact of immigration is on the employment and wages of natives?
If I had to summarize the economist's finding on the impact of immigrants on wages, employment, and price level in the U.S. economy, I would say that in aggregate, there is a certain consensus that they have a positive effect on the labor demand for U.S.-born workers. So this means that immigrants increase the size of the labor market, and this put some pressure on to increase average wage of U.S.-born workers. They don't crowd out, so they don't have a negative employment impact on them. And in some sectors, they also have this negative impact on prices. So they lower the price level in the economy.
So could I just follow up on that? So how is it that they have a kind of a slightly positive impact? I thought the conventional view was you have more people competing for the same jobs, that's going to reduce wages and will reduce living standards.
Yeah. So So this is the first part in which some people think that immigrant having a little positive impact on wage flies in the face of labor demand, labor supply. How can more worker increase wages? So the explanation is very sound and simple, and essentially the two key words are complementarity and specialization. Let me illustrate with an example. So think of a second of construction worker. Think of a situation in which the number of construction worker increases. More construction workers implies that more construction companies can enlarge their size of their operation. You can enlarge companies or create new companies. Now, when a construction company increases its size, of course, it's going to hire some of these construction workers, but it's also going to need construction engineer, construction supervisor, clerks, accountant, and people who do jobs in the company to produce the final product. Now, the key thing is that immigrant tend to take the construction worker type of jobs. Immigrant, if we're talking especially about low-educated immigrant, tend to take jobs which are more manual and physical intensive. And companies who come in need also jobs which are more communication intensive, interaction intensive, in order to produce the final product, which is a house, a building. And communication-intensive job are those construction supervisor, engineer, clerk, and accountant that I was saying. So in a sense, the word is that immigrants take jobs which are complementary to the jobs that native workers take. And if you think about the last decades in the labor market of the U.S., native U.S.-born workers have typically been moving out or taking more and more job in this communication and interaction intensive type of occupation, and fewer in the manual intensive type, because their average schooling has gone up, because their average income has gone up. And therefore, you can very well have an economy in which you some type of jobs, some type of worker, increase the demand for other type of workers. And this is the channel through which there is this pressure up on wages and employment. Let me add one more thing, which is important here, which this is useful to clarify. This also dispels or clarify another issue. The number of jobs in an economy is not fixed, so that you have that immigrant take some job and X minus the job taken are available for native. The number of jobs in an economy is determined by the supply of worker plus the action of firms that invest and generate jobs. And the presence of some type of worker generates demands for other type of job, and company that invest and grow create these other type of jobs. So the interaction between company and worker is what ultimately creates jobs. And again, the recent research that looks at this mechanism a little bit more in detail and specifically finds that there is this tendency of immigrant to specialize in the range of manual type of job, creating demand for this other job. And as native have been moving into this communication, cognitive, interactive job more and more, this has created this demand for them. Finally, this process also may generate, a pressure down on prices. Well, the possibility of hiring some manual workers to do some of these tasks and having a large supply keep the cost of this type of job and this type of services relatively low, and this allows a company to sell goods or services at a lower price. So in services like construction, gardening, household services, childcare, where the supply of these manual immigrant who do manual type of task has been large, have also helped keep relatively down the price of these type of services. So a little positive effect on the wage of native, a little negative effect on prices. You see that if you then calculate the effect on living standard, which depend on wages divided by price, could be important.
Thank you. Now, Jim, I wondered if I could draw you into this conversation here a little bit. So what Giovanni's done is, I think,
you don't draw the Godfather into the conversation. He joins when he wants to.
I wonder if I could kiss your pinky ring and encourage you to.
Carefully, yes.
So what Giovanni has laid out, I think, is a really compelling case or summary of the evidence that's available kind of for the average American. One thing that the Hamilton Project has been very focused on are the wages of people who, over the last three decades, people who have lower levels of skill. So people only with a high school degree or have not even completed high school. And there's been a lot of pressure on their wages over the last three decades. And is that in any way related to this immigration? Is Giovanni talking about the average, but we're missing important details about the lower end?
Well, I think he's talking about the whole
distribution. And the if you take the, I mean, immigrants, there are immigrants at the bottom with less scale who come. Then there are immigrants who come from Italy and become professors at American universities.
Oh, eventually godfathers.
Yes. So keep working on it. So the my summary of this related to Giovanni's paper is the dispute is mainly on the wage impact at the bottom. And Giovanni, his work, which is excellent work, tends to find a relatively small effect. If I go to the other extreme, and that would be Katz and Borjas, they find about 8-9% effect. Right? That's the range that we're talking about. Most people are in between that. But the really important point is, no matter which I believe to be true, I would still come to the conclusion, as all these authors do, that on average, immigration is a benefit to the U.S. economy. For many of the reasons that Giovanni spoke of, a little emphasis on the complementarity effect, but no matter what you think about the range of the estimate on the less skilled workers, they all conclude, on average, it's the economic benefit, just the economy alone, forgetting taxpayer effect, is positive.
Thank you. So why is there so much disagreement about that on cable TV?
I don't watch cable. Getting into the taxpayer, I don't know if you want to jump there.
Wait a second for that. But
all
due respect.
Some of it is there's more to economics on immigration, and there are social integration issues and things like that, and people's ability to deal with people who seem a little different. I think that's where most of the emotion comes from myself, not the economic effects. Although these economic effects that Giovanni and I talked about are positive, they're also small. They're not worth the attention. We're talking about, if we distributed it over the American population, I think the benefit would be like $30 to $50 per person from immigration. And you would say, well, that seems a little small to generate this kind of heat. So I think it's in the non-economic.
So I wanted to turn to Daryl now, who's done some very important work on high-skill immigration. And he has an excellent phrase that there are a series of future Einsteins out there in the great wide world, and that we're in an international competition to get them to locate in the United States and share their ideas and innovate and develop new businesses. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
I mean, even if there are only one future Einstein, that would be worth it right there. But in general, in my book, I suggest the United States needs to think more strategically about immigration, and particularly the relationship between immigration and long-term economic development. I mean, in a period of a recession or a slow economic recovery, I think in particular we need to focus on how immigration contributes to innovation, international competitiveness, and long-term job creation. When you look at other countries, a number of countries are much more strategic in how they think about this. I mean, for example, Canada devotes more than half of its visas to employment-based people. They basically target workers who are in short supply, and they go after those people. They try and find out, you know, who are the people who can contribute in the particular areas in which they are interested. When you compare that to the United States, our ratios are almost reversed. The numbers that we devote to visas for employment-based purposes are much lower. In recent years, either 15% or in some years less than 15% of our green cards have gone for employment-based visas. This includes both low-skill as well as high-skilled workers. When you look at the high-skilled worker by itself, in terms of green cards, we devote about 65,000 visas each year. That's only about 6% of the overall visas that we provide. The number that we provide actually has gone down over the course of the last decade. If you go back to the period from 1999 through 2004, we provided 195,000 visas, almost three times the current level for high-skilled workers. Now, why is this important? The reason why I think we should pay attention to this is 25% of the technology and engineering businesses that have been launched in America in recent years had an immigrant founder or co-founder. In Silicon Valley, that figure is 50%. When you look at the number of patents that are being filed in recent years, one quarter of all the U.S. patents have been based on the work of immigrants. When you go to leading companies, for example, Qualcomm, 72% of the patents that they filed were based on the work of foreign inventors. At Merck, 65%. General Electric, it's 64%. Cisco, it's 60%. So I did put a picture of Albert Einstein on the cover of my book just to remind people about the contributions that immigrants have made to American life over the years. I mean, we all know, for example, that Intel was founded by a Hungarian immigrant, Google was co-founded by a Russian immigrant, eBay was started by a Frenchman, and Yahoo was established by someone born in Taiwan. What would the American economy look like today if Intel were a Hungarian company, Google were based in Russia, eBay was in Paris, and Yahoo was a Taiwanese company? I think these are not isolated stories. Immigrants have made vital contributions to our economy, and we need an immigration policy that recognizes that fact and encourages immigration.
Thank you. Giovanni, you've also done some important work on the impact of immigrants on productivity in the United States.
Yeah, so I will talk about, I'm gonna go back to the low skill, but I wanna add one thing to the high skill consideration that we're just done. I think even more, we should think that probably Google, Yahoo, and this other company would have potentially not even existed if these people had not come to the United States. So there are a lot of economists who are studying the idea that is the combination of the brain plus sort of the research at the frontier that the US finds. So not only there are positive, this company have positive spillover on the US, they have positive spillover on the world economy, really. And a lot of research which happened, and because a smart scientist and engineer came to the US, probably would have not come if they had stayed in their country. Focusing though on, again, going back to the productivity impact. So that type of mechanism in which immigrants specialize in more manual type of jobs and the native specialize in more communication type of jobs. I want to bring it one step further because recent work seems to show that there is also an impact of this organization according to this specialization according to tasks seems to be some productivity effect, some efficiency effect. So think for a moment of the taxi industry. The taxi industry in a city in the 1970s was run by a bunch of individuals who were taking calls, writing down the booking for their taxis, driving the taxis, having the money, balancing the budget of their small company, and also maybe advertising for their little cab company. Then think of a large inflow of people, of immigrants, who could be taxi driver. They could be as good driver as native, but probably they don't speak English as well as native. So this creates an opportunity to reorganize this industry along a cab driver company, in which there is a call center where there are some call operators that pick up the call, and they need to speak English relatively well. They take the booking. And then there are some drivers who go around and drive people. And plus, this company also creates the need for some accountants, some people who take care of advertisement. Now, it's very likely, and this has happened in many other sectors, that this restructuring comes with an increase in efficiency. The big taxi company can provide the service either at low cost or a higher product, higher total services for a given number of workers. So when this restructuring happens and in the immigrant-native combination happens along this natural line of manual type of task and communication type of task, this can happen at the advantage with an increase of productivity, of efficiency. An increase in productivity means increase in wage for everybody, right? Because the productivity can be distributed within the company in wages or in profit as well. And the other effect that I was also mentioning, this come in lowering the price of some of these services that now benefit for this productivity advantage. So this other area of research, which I think has been not developed yet very much, but for instance, this in parallel, the same type of research exists when people look at impact on trade, on international competition. More competition, more specialization, this is the standard theory of trade, increases the efficiency and the productivity of the domestic industry. And what we are looking at recently is that there may be this effect and this impact on productivity in industries where immigrants are due to this specialization and restructuring seems to have earned some wage gain and productivity gain for several companies. So even at the low end of the skill spectrum, this incentive can create incentive for productivity increase. And of course, at the high end, the scientist and engineer, I think nobody disputes that the productivity growth of American firms depends in large part on technological innovation. And absolutely, as Daria was saying, immigrants are seems to be crucial to fuel this innovation and technological progress.
Thank you. I thought it would also be useful if we touched upon another topic that is quite controversial about immigration, and that's the fiscal impacts of immigration in the United States. And Jim has done a lot of very important work on that, and I thought, particularly as part of his National Academies of Science report, and I thought he might be able to tell us something about that.
Okay, so I want to start with what I consider the average effect, and just summarize it briefly. We estimated for the taxpayer effect for immigration, both at the state and local level, and the federal level, and did it not only at a point in time, but looking out way into the future and said, okay, what's the impact of an immigrant coming to the United States? So the bottom line would be, on average, the fiscal impact is positive. That is, they actually pay more taxes than they receive in benefits. The impact is more positive at the federal level and is slightly negative at the state and local level because immigrants are young, their kids are going to school, and they're helping to pay for the age-related programs at the federal level. So, and they're more negative, this is, of course has political implications, they tend to be more negative in the short term and positive in the long term. That's an average though. And within that average, there are some issues. And for example, let's take my favorite state randomly, California. California, we did an estimate for the state of California. And what I did is updated that estimate to give ballparkish today in today's prices and today's immigrant reality. The average native-born household in California pays $2,200 each year more in taxes than they receive in benefits from the state and local level because immigrants are, the foreign-born population is on the other side of that equation, receiving more in benefits than they pay in taxes. That is mostly have nothing to do, has to do with really two things. Immigrant incomes in California are relatively low and immigrants' children go to school. That's where all this effect comes from. But $2,200 is much bigger than any of these other numbers that we're talking about. To be a little provocative, but deliberately provocative, though, I would say right now, immigration is a negative for California because this taxpayer effect is so large relative to any benefits they get on the economic side. California is an extreme on this, though. So they're an outlier on this. When you do it for all the states, you get a slight positive effect. But those states that you read about in the newspapers right now, and you know Arizona, perhaps New Mexico, I'm not as knowledgeable as that states, the states where you hear some yelling going on, those in fact are the states where the state level and state and local level effects are negative. And if you go into communities, again, it's all being driven by schooling, those communities, the people on the other side of this have a point. These are negative effects, even though on average, across the entire country, it's a positive number.
So can I just pin you down a little bit on numbers? You say it's a positive number for state finances across the whole country?
Slightly, if you do states, all the states, you get a slightly negative number, which is overwhelmed by a much more positive number at the federal level. But you don't get a number anything like California. You get, you know,
So, but
$100, something.
And
like
if you
that.
Add it to state and the federal,
for the countries all, you get a positive number.
You get
and
positive.
It's that if you add the federal to California's yes. contribution, you don't change the number I gave you very much. So for California, that's why we had Prop 187 in California, and that's why the next set of states that started putting in these restrictions on benefits were the states they were. That's where the problems are. And we haven't gotten ourselves around that problem, that there are pockets in the country where this taxpayer effect is actually a big deal. And we can't ignore it, even though it comes out, on average, for everybody, okay.
And so in principle, and you and I have talked about this a little bit before, but in principle, since immigration is something that benefits the entire economy, the federal government, who is, I guess, net present value positive from immigrants, could share the cost of immigration.
That's one possible, we did talk about it before, that's one possible solution. The caveat I would put on that, as I told Michael before, is why, you know, the federal government does lots of things and that have distributional consequences around the country, different states benefiting more or less than one. What the argument that we would pick out immigration alone as the program and compensate California and compensate Arizona for their net deficits on that when they may be receiving positive deficits, yeah. some benefits somewhere else, that's a complicated issue. But you know, it is a potential yeah. way around this politically.
And then just, I want to flesh, I think this is a very central issue, and so I want to also flesh this out. Now, so that your 2,200 figure for California, that partially reflects the current age distribution of immigrants in California. So
yes.
as they age, they will no longer go to school, and in principle, they'll start paying into the tax system. So
wait, you're not talking about my kids. They age, and they always go to school. But the yes. So this
well, we're hoping our kids will leave our house yeah. eventually. But oh, that's,
you don't want that. So, trust me. The benefit. This number I gave you, if we took the present population
yes.
and pushed them into
yeah,
the future.
Yeah. So if we did a net present value right, calculation, yeah.
Right. That number would become smaller,
yeah.
and it would gradually fade away to a small negative number. But it's always going to be negative. And if I sum up all the, because it's always going to be negative, the budgets will balance between the native-born and the foreign-born households. And it will, so, but on average, if I do that calculation, it's still going to be a negative number in California, and a non-trivial negative number.
Could I just add one thing to what Jim is saying? I mean, this is a classic problem in American federalism. It's not unique to the immigration issue. We have lots of policy areas where there are disproportionate impacts that may fall on a handful of states. Now, you know, for example, defense base closings. You know, bases often are concentrated in the South and West, so when they close, oftentimes the federal government has compensated areas that are a hard hit. In the climate change area, and you have a disproportionate impact on coal-producing states. The problem in the immigration area, which has kind of been alluded to here, is the political problem, the paralysis at the national level. You know, when you kind of look at the numbers and the political dynamics of immigration, this is not an unsolvable problem. You know, we can deal with the issues of Arizona and California if the federal government were willing to take action. The problem in this area is really a problem of a federal government that is paralyzed by the immigration issue because it's so emotional and so controversial for people. It has become almost as much a political as an economic issue.
Can I also just add, yes.
Giovanni also lives in California.
I live in California, yeah. No,
he
so
wants
I'm going to say
you
something.
You want your money back.
Which,
so.
No, which is more on the so
like all
side,
Californians, Jim, they think that there's really only one state in the whole
yeah,
country.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We only think about yeah. California all the whole life. So I wanted to add, so James was emphasizing this issue of accounting for the fiscal impact at this time of over the lifetime of immigrants. And he actually really did the last very well done study on this, which to me dates 1997, because this is a very complicated thing to do. So what I wanted to emphasize is that very often I go on the web and I read some little study in which you can find the numbers which go all the way to become massive $1 million deficit caused by immigrants. So let me just give you an example. As he said, the problem is that people pay taxes along their life, okay? And many decisions and many government and many expenditure, you can consider them as pure expenditure. expenditure, or you can consider them as investments. So one reason why the immigrants are very costly is that their kids go to school, and you have a big school cost in terms of them. But there are two problems with this. One, the spending in education of a government is counted here as a pure spending. Economists think that that is an investment in which you increase the human capital of a person and you increase the tax-paying capacity of the person in the long run. So if you account for that, you have a different type of accounting. Second, many of these studies are done with the head of the household being an immigrant. The kids are American-born. So here, do you treat this kid differently? So where you cut the separation and the accounting makes a difference for the results that you get. So honest economists who do a good job tell you what their assumptions are, but you need to do a lot of assumption here to go there and get some number. And then you find a lot of studies that give you a number and you don't know how it's found. So I just want to warn that this is a serious problem. And as far as I'm concerned, the last serious study was this one, which was done by Jameson co-author. And there is a lot of stuff around which I've read and I'm not too convinced about.
Can I make one more point on this, Michael?
You agree with his assessment of your work?
That it, yeah. The Godfather is pleased. It's the one thing we haven't touched on here. The other dimension, and I'll use education as a indicator of skill, is that these taxpayer effects are very, very different depending on your education, mostly because your income is going to be high. You'll pay more taxes, a little bit of fertility in this as well. So if you do the calculation for high educated people like Giovanni, you are, thank you for coming. You are an enormous bonus. I've spent the money already, but you are an enormous bonus. So when you look at the economic effect that Giovanni was talking about there, you say, well, the benefits greater or less at the high school level, the low school level. And I think they're at both levels, and I'm not sure how I would answer that question. But on the taxpayer effect, it's clear what the answer is. The benefits are much, there's a pro-skill bias to this, or pro-education bias to this part of the economic argument. High-educated, high-income immigrants are much better than low-educated immigrants who have low income. And the other thing you asked me before, which I didn't bring in, is what causes all this emotion? We haven't talked yet about the undocumented immigrant issue. That causes a lot of the emotion. And they tend to be on the less skilled, providing an economic benefit, but potentially coming along also with a taxpayer cost. And then you wrapped up into the that they are, in fact, undocumented, they're not legal immigrants. I think a lot of the emotion comes right around that issue.
You know, Jim is mentioning the clear value at the high-skilled end. But there's an irrationality to how we treat, for example, international students who come to the United States to study in the classic STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and math. Before I came to Brookings 2 years ago, I taught at Brown University. You can go into the physics department, chemistry, biology, engineering. It's like in most major American universities, two-thirds of the graduate students now come from abroad. You know, American students are not studying these topics to the extent that we should. But yet, we then invest, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars training these international students. Many of them would actually like to stay here and become like Giovanni. They do not have the opportunity. So, for example, one policy idea that has been suggested just to deal with that aspect is automatic green cards for foreign students who get PhDs in any of the science and technology and engineering fields. That's a way, you know, when you think about the investment that we make in international students studying at American universities, but then we don't take advantage of that investment, you know, these are the people who are going to, if they stay here, who are going to be the innovators. They're going to launch businesses. They're going to create jobs. They're going to raise the level of economic activity for a lot of other people.
There's another question I think is part of the controversy, and that is I think there's sometimes a sense that immigrants come to the United States and don't integrate into larger society, and you can see that internationally. You see these French laws banning burqas, and I know Jim has done some important research on that as well, and I wondered if you could talk to what you think the facts are on that case, on that question.
Well, my parents were immigrants to the United States, so I grew up in an immigrant household in which I thought everyone in the world spoke with an Irish accent no matter where they were from, because everyone I heard spoke with an Irish accent. I think the experience of the United States is an extremely positive one on integration of immigrants and their own self-integration into the United States. And it's not just the European immigrants that, you know, that came 70, 80 years ago, where they're all just us. We don't even know where they came from now. The amount of progress, and I'll take Mexican immigrants, where I did a study, I looked at how much, generation by generation, how much they improved their education, how much they improved their income, took it out three generations, and then compared them to the Europeans. And there was a lot of discussion, partly because of language, partly because it was a large group, the border was close so you could go back, that they weren't integrating into in the same way the Europeans did. And it's just not true. Their progress across generations was much more rapid. And the Europeans were outstanding enough. They were much more rapid than the Europeans. And so third generation, you know, everyone thinks of a Mexican immigrant as some unskilled new immigrant here. Their grandchildren are here, and their grandchildren are graduating from Harvard and doing the things that other immigrants do. So economically, they've integrated. Socially, it may be to the lament of the immigrants. One of my most favorite immigrant movies, I think it's called The New Land, is where these people who struggle, you know, for hours and hours, and it was awful, people died, and they finally, their grandchildren were around this old man who spoke pretty much only Swedish, and they're making fun of him. And he couldn't relate to them, but it was the success of the immigrant experience. The reason the assimilation goes on so smoothly here is marriage. People are marrying across ethnic lines. And by the time you get to the third generation, we are all partly one thing and partly another thing and partly something else. It's very, very rare to have three generations where you only have Irish heritage or Mexican heritage. And biology and social groupings are taking care of this problem with that. If that's not true, you know, we know the French experience and other experiences elsewhere where people live for generation after generation in enclaves with very little positive communication across groups, including very little intermarriage. And so I think we should be proud of our experience.
I want to follow up and add.
You probably married an Irish girl. Is that what
I married an American girl. So I want to add up something, because I think there is something to be learned. I'm spending a period in Europe now, back there. And there, the debate about immigration, the impact on job, and their assimilation is also very raging and very animated. And I wanted to compare here. I think here, the U.S. had two things which have served, in spite of all the imperfection and problem, very well in these terms. One is this fact that whoever is born in the U.S. is American. And European countries don't have this jus soli, it's called in Latin, which implies that you can invest in your kids and know that they are American citizens. If they're going to be sticking around and studying, they're going to have all the same rights as the U.S. I think this is a strong mechanism, an engine to create integration and to create investment in the important human capital characteristics of people and future citizens and future worker. The other is that the immigration in the U.S., as much as this is in spite of the immigration system, in fact, is an immigration for work, for jobs. You're absolutely right. Most of these immigrants on the paper are family reunification. I am a family reunification. I would have not been an American green card if not for my wife. However, the real reason it attracts a lot of people is employment. And you see this on the statistic. The unemployment rate among immigrants in the United States, even among the least educated, is much lower than the unemployment rate of native. The opposite is true in Europe. In Europe, to the contrary, very often, there is a little difficulty of immigrants to get into the market because the market is more insider-outsider organized. So the competition and the sort of more flexibility of the American market makes immigrants come to work. And I think work is step number one to integrate, to really have people integrated in the society. And in France, the problem of banlieue separation comes in large part because unemployment rate, these people have a hard time in entering this, unions are relatively strong, the insiders power of native workers is strong. So I think in this American dream that is part of the imaginary of a lot of families in the US, you come here, you don't have much, but you come to work, you work hard, you make success, and your kids do, I think it has some real value, it's a real icon of the US, and it is happening in many cases, more than in Europe right now.
There's another question I wanted to turn to, and I mentioned at the outset. The best estimates are that about 30% of immigrants are undocumented, there's been a great public concern about that, and our spending on Border Patrol, I think, has doubled more or less since 9/11, obviously partially related to those issues, but I think also to kind of plain vanilla immigration. And in the face of that doubling, I think we now spend about $17 billion a year. Actually, the best estimates of the number of undocumented immigrants have continued to increase. So I wonder if any of you have any thoughts about undocumented immigration, what its economic impacts are, what might be more effective ways to address this problem?
You want me to solve it for you, then?
Based on facts.
Yeah. My only weapon, facts. I think everything that Darryl said about which is basically the legal immigration system, getting visas and stuff like that, I would agree 100% with. The benefits are clearly positive, and we have to increase it, not leave it where it is. We have to increase it. The real issue.
Is that a statement about all immigration or high skill immigration?
The high skill, but mostly through the legal immigration process, that's mostly high skilled immigration. The issue is, in fact, that we have to deal with as a country is what about the undocumented immigrant problem? And we have 12 million undocumented, we're not starting from scratch here. We have 12 million undocumented migrants in the United States. They have come over a long period of time. They have come with our implicit non-opposition, let us say, right? I think the border, I'm not an expert, and it probably reduces the number. It clearly doesn't stop the flow very much because we've gone from much smaller numbers to where we are now. So the question that I think that, and I would say on that, you could make an economic case as well that because of these taxpayer effects, that the economic side, on the economic side, undocumented immigrants are negative for the United States, not positive, okay? But now we're faced with 12 million people here, already here. And to me, it's unimaginable. I'll show you how much a non-politician I am. I'd give them amnesty, okay, in a second. But I would group it with a real pledge that the problem is not enforcement on the border. The problem is enforcement in the interior. There is essentially no enforcement on the interior. Unless you actually commit a crime, you're pretty much going to be allowed to stay. I think that has to stop. And in the future, it has to be a commitment that people who are here without documents, illegally in the future, are in fact sent back. We don't wait for a crime. They are, in fact, sent back. I think a combination, but I'm like the worst politician in the world, of resolving the current issue on the 12 million already here, but stopping the flow in the future with enforcement on the interior would be the way I would suggest going.
I mean, I think this is an interesting area just because this is an area where there is so much misunderstanding about what the problem is. Like, we have 12 million undocumented people here. like, I think many Americans believe that all of those 12 million kind of crawled across the Mexican border. The interesting thing is 40% of those people who are here illegally basically came here legally through tourist visas or other legitimate visas and then overstayed their visa. They just simply came here and then stayed. They did not go home. And so, for example, we put all this money into border security. We built the fence along the Mexican border. We've added border patrol agents. And that actually is reducing the flow. The Border Patrol Administration keeps annual statistics on this. We actually have a success story. The numbers are down to a 30-year low. So we are making progress on border security. But yet, you could have the flow of Mexicans across our border being at zero. There still are a lot of people who are going to be here through undocumented means because they're coming here and then overstaying their visas. The only way to really deal with that is through workplace enforcement. And one of the changes we've seen from the Bush to the Obama administration is Bush did a lot of workplace raids, targeted the employees, put the onus on them. Obama has shifted that onus and is now kind of going after employers and basically putting more of the responsibility on them. But those are the types of tricky issues that you start to get into when you get into the issue of undocumented.
Can I add a little? So also in the spirit of facts.
You are legal.
Last time I checked, yeah. And I agree. This is a complicated issue. I just want to introduce two facts that I think we cannot avoid when we discuss this. So one is that I always plot at the beginning of this immigration course I have this graph of immigrants by skills. And there is a graph which does similarly. So essentially, the U.S. receive a lot of immigrants who are very highly skilled relative to native, not too many in the middle, and a lot of immigrants which are very low level of education. The part that comes through the official door is the high spike here, and many of the people who have low level of education come in undocumented. Now, the problem, the issue is that what I argue is that there is an economic reason, and there is, and this U-shape form of skills has served the U.S. very well. And the economic reason for the high demand of low skilled is the one that I was telling you. Americans are moving out of some of these manual jobs, but the demand for some of these services, care of the elderly, child care of the house, is increasing because the population is aging, because the population is becoming richer, because women are joining the labor force. So to me, the crucial thing is that there is a potential demand for this low-skilled worker, but there is essentially no documented way, unless you have a relative in the United States, to enter the market. So far, what I see, the problem of the undocumented need to me to be solved at the same time as the problem of generating a certain number of documented visa. So here there is a guest worker program or program for low educated people in particular occupation. It seems to me that as long as we don't solve the problem of admitting them, the enforcement only will not work. The other thing I wanted to say about the undocumented, to add to the point that 40% enter and so that how the border is not going to solve everything, there are recent estimates that also estimate that on top of this 40%, are other 20-30% of the undocumented are people who, in perspective, are going to be documented. So many of them have a brother, a sister, so they could family reunify and be legal in the U.S., except that the Homeland Security has a backlog of 20 years. So these people will essentially eventually become documented. If the system was working like this, they would already, in a sense, be documented. So the problem is complicated because then people say, oh, these people have violated the law, and so they need to pay. And that's correct in many cases. In many cases, the situation is there is some gray area of some people who stay here and work in the meantime, and then they become actually documented, other people who go back and forth. So I see this issue so very much connected with the labor demand issue and how to solve this supply or a labor supply of low skilled, that solving only that one, I think, will not close this topic, this issue.
Thank you. Okay, so we thought we would open the floor to questions. You can have 3 truly world-class experts, you should give them hell. So I think Bob Rubin would like to start by asking a question.
Mine is just a very micro question. When you said that in California there was a net loss of reasons described on a fiscal basis, does that include the revenues from the tourism industry, or does that include the
Yeah, it includes everything. Incidence of property tax, any tax or any source of revenue, any source of, includes everything.
Okay, we have a question here in front.
Thank you. I'm Peggy Orchowski. I'm from California. I'm the congressional correspondent for the Hispanic Outlook magazine on higher education. Daryl, we've talked before, but as you know, there's the foreign students, they hit the 600,000 mark last year, the first time they are over 600,000. So we have more foreign students now than ever before. The majority of them are graduate students. And they're not all going to, you name four companies, they're not all going to form Googles and all that. There is a lot of sympathy in Congress for giving green cards to them. And as you know, not only two-thirds are in that STEM field and many of them want to stay, many departments, including mine, in University of California, over 100% of the research assistants and teaching assistants are foreign students because they can only work on campus. So American students are being deprived of the chance to get a research assistant or to get a teaching assistantship because foreign students basically own them. And most professors admit this. So, you know, the big question for a lot of Americans is, why aren't American kids studying? Are we really favoring foreign students? And many of them pay three times more tuition, too, than Americans. So is there a bias? Of course, the questions here are, you are not talking about the American worker, but there is a huge impact on the American work on many of the things you're talking about. So why aren't Americans studying? The other question is, on the other end, there's been a lot of bills by Dianne Feinstein to have really good agricultural bills, agricultural jobs bills, called ag jobs. Almost always they've been stopped by the Hispanic caucus because they want a pathway to citizenship added to these. And my question is, if farm workers and low-skill workers are legalized, now they have a chance to do jobs other than farm workers. If they become Americans, aren't they going to become like every American? They aren't going to do those kind of jobs. So who are going to do those kind of jobs?
On the STEM subject and why American students are not studying there, I think you're perfectly correct to point out that the high-skilled worker problem that the United States has is not just a function of immigration, that it's a problem we ourselves are creating in the sense that our students are not going into those fields. So then the question is, well, why aren't American students studying science, technology, engineering, and math? And when I talk with my friends at Brown who were in the physics department or chemistry or biology or engineering, you know, they're hard subjects. They're topics that require years of training. I think when you look at our secondary schools, this is a problem of the weak secondary schools that we have that are not kind of teaching those subjects in a way that encourages people to come into the fields. There's a particular issue in terms of attracting women into these fields. These have been male-dominated fields, and women have faced some barriers in terms of getting entry into them. So I think we do need to kind of think about a STEM strategy that would lower the barriers, improve secondary education teaching of these subjects so that then when someone hits college as an undergraduate, that they start thinking about these topics in a more serious way than they do right now.
Can I answer the question about the agricultural worker? I think, I mean, so there is some work on what impact would have a legalization on the opportunity, the employment opportunity of undocumented. And some people find some effect. But I think what some people find is that most of the labor market positioning of these people is linked to their skills. These people have a very low level of schooling, and they don't speak English very well. And they're very hard workers. essentially, on the other hand. It's very hard to find a native worker with this combination, a US-born. And so when there was this decrease in agricultural worker come in, I had this friend in California who owned vineyards, some economists as well, who were telling that that year they couldn't find anybody who harvest, and they could increase the wage a little bit. They had to increase all the way to the level in which it was not for them profitable anymore to do that. So in a sense, I think that legalization on the perspective, it will not completely change the perspective of these people. But on the other hand, I see why sort of if you want to sort of if you want to have these people, the Hispanic group wants them to have a pathway to be resident as the other. So I think that regularization will not change too much in the first in the short run for sure. The labor market perspective of these people, but will change their life perspective very much. Yes, because they are finally.
Okay, I think we have time for just two more very quick questions. But we have very important coffee time outside, so we don't.
Judd Herriot, Judd Herriot, documentary filmmaker. The immigrants that I've come in contact with, we're talking about undocumented, unskilled. It's purely a cash economy. They're paid in cash. They don't pay taxes. They send their money home to their families. How, to what extent have you been able to capture this sector in your research? And to what extent does it influence your results?
I think that's a fantastic question.
That's a great question.
Either Jim or Giovanni. Do you want to start with that, Jim?
Okay. Go ahead, Jim.
No, it is a good question.
It's a good question.
One of the things that people tend not to tell you when they have surveys is that they're here in the country illegally. That's, they're not offering that piece of information. But we know enough about the, you know, where these people are working, what jobs they're in, what their skill levels are, that we know that in those types of, you know, let's say we're talking about farm workers in California, people with sixth, seventh grade education, we're going to get lots of undocumented workers in that population. So we always have to do it in a sort of backhanded way. In these are the traits, and in those traits, in some of these occupations, 90% of people in the occupation are foreign born. So it is highly, especially in California, highly concentrated. So that is the way we learn. I mean, if I could wish for a little more information, it would be, in fact, really documenting how many kids in an undocumented worker, you know, getting, not having to guess so much when we do the studies.
So I guess another way of saying exactly what Jim said is that I think, so the American Census and the American Community Survey, which is the yearly version of the census, are pretty good at reaching every single person who's resident on the U.S. as well. There are estimates that say that maybe the undocumented, given that they move around a lot, can be a little underestimated or undercounted. However, I think in the last 10 years, from 2000 to this census, we've done big progress. So we're pretty good at counting all immigrants in the U.S. So all the stuff that I, all my research, all my results are essentially the impact of all immigrants. And when I talk about low-educated immigrants are all people who are foreign-born of low education. What we're not very good at is in distinguishing who's documented and who's not. In the census, of course, you cannot because this question is not asked. The estimate we have of that, look at the census number and subtract the official number of Homeland Security. So by subtraction, and this introduces some mistake, but I would say that all we are relatively good at saying all the effect that we were talking about, at least that I was talking about on the labor market, should include all of them because it's on a survey per person interview which don't ask the legal status of this.
Okay, I think we have time for one final question.
Good choice. Hi, my name is Caitlin Corbin with the Cato Institute. We've talked a lot about California, but we haven't talked about Texas at all, or hasn't been mentioned. And theoretically, it would be in kind of a similar situation, if immigration was really the source of so many problems, it would be in a similar fiscal situation, and it's light years ahead of where California is. And I'm from California, so. I was wondering if there's anything meaningful to be gained by looking at how Texas handles its undocumented immigrants versus how California has.
Yeah. For sure, and I use California because that's where we did the study, okay? And Texas would have been the alternative. But another really good thing about the United States is we have 50 states trying to solve these problems. And if Texas is doing a better job than California. Let's learn from them. I mean, this is, you know, the emotions around immigration right now, it's always been there. That isn't new. But they're really getting a little too hot. And, you know, it's starting to get a little ugly, I think. And maybe after the election, things will cool down again. But to learn from another state seems the most obvious thing in the world to me.
I have a quick thing to say specifically on the Texas-California, because this was actually the subject of a very interesting study by Gordon Hanson and Matthew Slaughter, who are two economists. And they were actually noticing that California and Texas received the same number of immigrant and undocumented. However, the opinion in Texas, this was in the 90s, even the Republicans of Texas were much less anti-immigration. George W. Bush is one of them. And the thing that they said is essentially, well, Texas is much less generous in many welfare program than California. Texas is a large government, is a very small government relative to California, and in cross-country study, comparing Europe and the U.S., you tend to see that countries with smaller governments have less of this public opinion against immigrants, because at least the feeling is that there is not so much transfer, so they're not so much on the fiscal budget of the state. So that can be an interesting difference.
Okay, I want to thank our panelists, but before we thank them officially, we have now seated everyone in this room with 10 facts and probably a couple more, and our hope is that this will help make the discussion around immigration and the policy debate a little bit more fact-based, and we're counting on all of you to take that as your own charge. So can you join me in thanking our three excellent panelists?